in this case, out of sequence in the afternoon. We're sitting today with Judge Lucero, Judge Moritz. And our newer protocol is to extend oral argument for our capital habeas cases, so you'll have 30 minutes per side. For the appellants, try to keep your rebuttal time within that 30 minutes or so. This is our only case on this slide, so we can be somewhat flexible. And I think Mr. Nancher, representing the petitioner, you may proceed if you're ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, I am Bob Nance, representing Gilbert Postel. I'm joined at council table with my colleague John Carlson. I would like to begin, to the extent possible, I'd like to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, but I understand how things flow. I'd like to begin by talking about the deficiencies of appellate counsel leading up to the 2009 filing of the appeal brief, and I think we can sweep up the trial counsel problems at the same time. Appellate counsel was confronted with a case in which Gil Postel was sentenced to two separate death sentences in addition to two life without paroles. And given the amount of Flynn effect cases that I'll talk about a little later or whenever you want me to, appellate counsel should have raised the Flynn effect evidence under two separate lines of cases. In keeping with our COA for appellate ineffective assistance, that would be an Atkins claim under the Atkins line of cases, and then as relevant mitigating evidence under the Lockett and Eddings line of cases.
Well, on the first half of that, wasn't that pretty much disposed of by the OCCA's later, or roughly contemporaneous, ruling that Flynn effect evidence wasn't relevant for in an Atkins case?
Yes. As regards the state law issue or the, right. the state court issue in Smith shortly later, they came down with that and then repeated it on appeal in this case. Nevertheless, I think...
When was the DSM-5, what year was that promulgated by the American Psychological Association?
Judge, I don't know that I've got that. I think
isn't
it was,
that a critical question?
It was by this time, I believe, and...
That's been an evolving concept over the years, but it was formalized.
It has been an
DSM-5.
Yes, sir. It has been an evolving concept. Dr. Flynn first published something on it in 1984, and it's kind of picked up speed since then. If we can get that date for you, I'll give it to you, perhaps on rebuttal.
But anyway, it seems like the appellate ineffectiveness is tied to the trial counsel, and you know, to summarize your argument, trial counsel should have argued the Flynn effect as part of his mitigation.
Absolutely.
That's right.
And I have a narrower COA there. But just to explain as quickly as I can how I think that should have played out, appellate counsel should have raised both lines of mm-hmm. cases, and I believe was deficient for not arguing Atkins, although a couple of cases of this court probably deprived me of any prejudice from that failure. But should have used Rule 311 of the Court of Criminal Appeals, should have filed the appellate brief alleging that her colleague in the same office had been deficient as trial counsel and laid out by affidavit what an expert should have said if called into trial court.
Well, the trial counsel did put on a mental health defense and had a couple of mental health experts, right?
She did, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And do we know if those specialists advised trial counsel about the Flynn effect and its possible use as a part of the...
We do not know that.
The mental retardation piece. Of
we don't know that, and it's not in the record, Your Honor.
Well, if we don't know that, we don't know then whether trial counsel made a strategic choice to not use Flynn effect evidence or was never advised about the efficacy of the Flynn effect by the experts they retained.
Well,
how do we get over deficiency if we don't know whether there was a strategic choice at play here?
Because the strategic choice had to be the lawyers, not the experts.
Right, and what do we know about that?
Well, we know that the testing contemporaneous with the trial was that there were two IQ tests given. One yielded a 76 and one yielded a 79.
I know, but we don't know. On this record, we don't know about the trial counsel's thought processes on putting together the mitigation case. I mean, don't we need to know something about that? Otherwise, we're just assuming that he didn't know about the Flynn effect and was ineffective under your theory. But if he did know about the Flynn effect and chose to pursue what he thought was a better mitigation defense, and that wouldn't be ineffective.
And the trial court or the trial court lawyer, of course, had a duty to act with an objective standard of reasonableness and make reasonable investigations.
We don't have any record on that, though. I mean, there's no affidavit from trial counsel.
That's correct,
right?
Your Honor.
There was no evidentiary hearing that would tease that out.
Yeah, they asked for an evidentiary hearing on post-conviction, and we asked for an evidentiary hearing in federal court and got neither one. But when you know that Atkins has come down and that an IQ of 70 is life and death significant, and you know that the Flynn effect has been out there and came down in published opinions and in the legal defense bar articles,
it was out there, but it surely wasn't well known. It wasn't strongly established. And even today, I mean, there's some conflicting theories or thoughts on it. And certainly at that time, there could have been a strategy choice not to retain an expert because it would have potentially become a battle of experts.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's nothing
and that might have taken
experts.
The focus away, as the state argues, I think, that could have taken the focus away from some strong mitigating evidence.
It wouldn't, Your Honor. There is some mitigating evidence in the record, and there's some evidence that Gill has mental problems. He had an IEP. That's in the record from post-conviction when he was in school before he left at 12, and he had emotional problems, and there was a lot of that. But to say not only all of that, but when you correct for the stale norms and the tests that that he was given, he would have met the intellectual deficiency component of mental retardation, as the term was in those days.
Well, counsel, if my preliminary research is correct, the American Psychiatric Association adopted the DVM in 2013. So at that point, I mean, they may have had theory about the Flynn effect and some disputation in the literature on the point, but at 2013, you're no longer talking theory. It became a diagnostic indicator of the American Psychiatric Association. Now, Hall then followed, and Hall v. Florida was decided in 2014. The Oklahoma statute in question, what year was that adopted?
Well, the Oklahoma statute at the time, just a moment, Your Honor.
The Oklahoma statute cannot be said to have been adopted in furtherance of or in compliance with Hall.
Correct. Correct.
So for our purposes, for constitutional analysis, for our decision tree, what we have to look at is Hall v. Florida 2014.
No, Your Honor, that's one of the two lines
of
cases.
Well, that's the line I'm following for the moment, if I may.
All right, sir.
And under Hall v. Florida, I think we were instructed, not suggested, but were instructed that a rigid score of whatever absolute number was chosen was an unacceptable means of for determination of intellectual competency, and that instead we had to look at the situation holistically. Is that a fair summary of what Hall said?
That is a fair summary of Hall, yes, sir.
Now, if Hall then tells us that this gentleman should have been evaluated holistically, it seems to me, just as I said on my preliminary research, that it would be unacceptable to suggest that a state could mandate, any state could mandate absolute cutoffs in the face of Hall.
I think that's
moreover, it would be to suggest that Flynn should not have been considered as a factor after 2013 for habeas purposes or for any purpose. It would be, again, inappropriate. And the only question really is whether a defense lawyer, in proceeding competently, would have been introducing evidence in mitigation that would be roughly pointing the court and the jury in those directions. Now, I know I'm sort of giving a speech instead of a question right now, but it's going to be followed by a question, and that is, it seemed, and the suggestion has been made, that defense counsel was somehow following some other strain of defense, and that to do whatever that may have been, he introduces evidence that by an expert that this gentleman is not.
You are absolutely right, Your Honor.
Under what conceivable theory could such a position be taken that would meet constitutional norms? That's a question.
There is no conceivable theory under which that met constitutional norms, particularly in light of Atkins. You know that Atkins is a complete bar to execution. And getting ready to go to trial in 2008, you had a guy who was within a hair's breadth with unadjusted scores of being able to take advantage of Atkins. And instead of using the Flynn effect to get you where you needed to be, and the Flynn effect adjusts those scores, 76 and 79, down to about 73 or 74. That's two different tests, but that's where you would have been. You would have been below the cutoff of 176, which is in the statute and which the Court of Criminal Appeals relied on. You would have been below. You would have been in the area where the standard error of measurement would have put part of that range below 170. You would have a range from like 68 to 78, approximately, and that would have entitled Mr. Postel through an expert to have an expert say that this man qualifies on the intellectual deficiency component to be mentally retarded.
Using numerical scores alone, but he could have additionally introduced not subjective, but other evidence in mitigation to that effect.
And there's other evidence available about his limitations of adaptive functioning and all of that. So it's there in the record. I'm talking about the point score.
Didn't one of the defense experts opine that he was not intellectually disabled?
Absolutely. And pointlessly. Self-defeatingly so.
And that's your claim.
That's our claim.
Incompetent counsel.
That no competent counsel would have put an expert on the stand to say he's not mentally retarded or intellectually disabled when, by simply explaining the Flynn effect, you make the scores more accurate and he gets the benefit of hearing an expert tell the jury that this young man is, at least in terms of the intellectual score, mentally retarded. Because that name carries a lot more explanatory power than does, well, he was He's 73 instead of 76. He's 73 instead of 79.
Now, on a related point, there's a case out of our circuit that dealt with the Flynn effect. Judge Gorsuch was on panels, as I recall. What is that case, and what year was it decided?
Well, I looked to Smith because it's a 2016 case, and it follows the part of the Oklahoma cases. You may be talking about Hooks versus Workman, which was 2012.
2012.
Yes, sir.
That case held what?
Hooks held basically that in the context of federal habeas corpus, if you're making an Atkins claim, you have to go with the precise holding of Atkins, and the Atkins case nowhere said you can use Flynn effect evidence.
Right.
And so in the narrow context of what you can bring up in a habeas corpus case under the AEDPA, the court said and then said again in Smith that there's no requirement under Atkins to use Flynn effect evidence.
Now, those cases precede Hall.
They precede Hall, yes.
And they precede, at least the first of the cases, precedes the adoption of the 2013 DBM-5 by the American Psychiatric Association.
Correct, Your Honor, but they post-date my man's trial. But if you look at the other line of cases, the Lockett-Eddings cases, those cases say relevant mitigating evidence is extremely broad. And anything that has to do with character, record, or circumstances of the offense that makes a fact of importance more or less likely is admissible as relevant mitigating evidence. Well, whether or not my client was mentally retarded or intellectually disabled was certainly a relevant question. And the state doesn't even dispute that Flynn evidence would be relevant mitigating evidence because it makes his intellectual disability more likely rather than less likely. So under that long, very well-established line of cases, including Eddings, because it's an Oklahoma case, in Eddings, the trial judge says, well, no, I'm not going to consider as mitigating evidence the fact that the guy's father beat him, he had a terrible home life, and he had emotional difficulty.
So and the trial was in 2008?
The trial was in 2008, fall of 2008.
And I want to make sure I understand your argument. Was the trial counsel categorically ineffective for failing to present Flynn effect evidence to the jury?
Yes. Yes, I believe so. And by that time, there had been at least four federal appellate court cases. They're on page 23 of our brief, Walker versus True, which is an interesting case. It lays out the whole thing. I mean, how to use Flynn effect evidence.
But there wasn't a Tenth Circuit or Supreme Court case that would have.
There was not.
Held so. How do we get over AEDPA deference then?
I'm sorry?
How do we get over the OCCA's determination that the trial counsel was not deficient, nor was the presentation of the evidence prejudicial?
Well,
we defer to that unless it's an unreasonable application of clearly established
and it absolutely,
Supreme Court law.
It absolutely is.
And which case is that?
Well, it's the whole line of Sixth Amendment cases that talk about duty.
We're on ineffective assistance. It's got to be this is a Strickland.
Right, Strickland and the cases that follow it. What the Court of Criminal Appeals said was, under the Oklahoma statutory scheme, even if Flynn effect evidence is valid, regardless of its validity, it is irrelevant to the mental retardation determination in a capital case. That means if Flynn effect evidence was the scientific gold standard, you could not use it. And because you could not use it, no lawyer who failed to use it would be ineffective. Now, that's not the law.
Well, apart from that argument, though, in answer to Judge Simkovich's question, I thought your argument was not only that he was deficient for failing to introduce Flynn evidence, but he was also ineffective for failing to introduce other mitigating evidence of such retardation.
And
is that correct? Is it?
That's kind of originally correct, but on our COA, we're talking about Flynn.
Solely Flynn.
I believe that's the limit of my COA in the case. So that's kind of what I'm prepared to talk about. If the standard is, did you make a reasonable investigation of the Strickland standard of where you were at the time you went to trial, and you thought as a lawyer, you just couldn't introduce relevant mitigating evidence that showed a proper assessment of this man's IQ was not 76 and 79, but was down into the range that got him either under the Atkins line to a complete freedom from execution, or under the Eddings and Lockett line was relevant mitigating evidence, you would have been dead wrong. I mean, that's part of the problem that the Court of Criminal Appeals created, Your Honor, when it said you just can't use it no matter what, and no lawyer would have used it.
You know, I think one of the state's argument that this particular argument wasn't fairly presented to the OCCA in the initial state habeas petition. Can you just explain why you think that argument's erroneous?
Well, on page 10 of the post-conviction relief application, the counsel in post-conviction went through, how he was mentally retarded and that should have been brought up, but then said, even if that doesn't work, it should be introduced as relevant mitigating evidence. So it's not that they hid the ball. They did not develop that as well as I'm trying to develop
it's
here.
It's one sentence. I mean, it's one sentence.
It's one sentence, but it is fairly presented. It's not raising an issue now that wasn't raised then.
I know, but it's in a section that talks about Atkins.
They did bring in the second line, which is the Eddings and Lockett line, and it's certainly within the scope of the Eighth Amendment, and it's certainly within the scope of the Sixth Amendment in Strickland.
The only case cited in that section is Atkins.
That's probably correct, Your Honor. And the Court of Appeals didn't mention, Court of Criminal Appeals didn't mention Atkins or relevant mitigating evidence at all. I mean, it just said, as a matter of state law, you can't do it. So, no lawyer who didn't do it can be defective. And there could be no prejudice from not doing the impossible. They just simply hermetically sealed the question as a matter of state law and didn't address the federal constitutional law at all. And to the extent, the effect of what they did was clearly, it violated clearly established law under the Strickland line and then under Eddings.
Did you argue Lockett and Eddings to the OCCA?
I don't recall. I mean, I didn't, but I don't recall whether that was mentioned in the post-conviction brief or not. I can look at that.
We'll take a look. I know you wanted to reserve some rebuttal time. So,
all right. Do you have any questions about what we've discussed heretofore up to now?
Well, we'll follow up.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Let's hear from the state. Ms. Hunt?
May it please the Court, I'm Caroline Hunt from the Oklahoma Attorney General's Office on behalf of Respondent. So starting with ground one, ineffective assistance of counsel, as discussed in my brief, part of this claim is unexhausted, and I'm happy to discuss that further if this Court wishes. However, the easiest way for this Court to dispose of this claim is on the merits, and so I'll start there. As a preliminary matter, I would just like to short title how I'm going to talk about the two aspects of this claim, because as this Court has discussed, and Petitioner's Counsel has discussed, it has two aspects. So when I refer to the mitigating aspect, I'm talking about what I call the mitigating Flynn effect ineffective assistance claim in my brief, this idea that trial counsel should have presented Flynn effect evidence as general mitigating evidence. And then when I refer to the Atkins aspect, I'm referring to the claim that trial counsel should have presented Flynn effect evidence in support of a freestanding Atkins claim. And these are, of course, ineffective assistance claims. So the ultimate issue in this case is whether the Court of Criminal Appeals decision denying relief on this claim is contrary to or an unreasonable application of Strickland. And I'd like to start by pointing out something about the timing. I agree with you, Judge Lucero, that that is critical. At the time of the 2008 trial, you are correct, Your Honor, that the DSM-5 had not come out yet. It did not come out until 2013.
Can I just pause, hit the pause button right there?
Yes, Your Honor.
The studies by the American Psychiatric Association that led to its promulgation in 2013 had commenced in 2000. Mm-hmm. So as a general psychiatric proposition, it was not at the theory stage. It was at the study stage, mm-hmm. starting in 2000. And then you have these intervening circuit cases in which it is starting to be, in some cases, discussed, in other cases, adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want you to factor in that timeline in your answer as to mm-hmm. whether a reasonably effective trial lawyer trying to save his client from the death penalty would have prepared himself and been prepared to introduce evidence on that point.
Your Honor, counsel at the time, even if Flynn effect is out there in studies and in some of the cases, the DSM, my understanding is it is essentially like the mental health Bible for practitioners and defense counsel.
Right.
And the DSM-4-TR that was in place at the time of trial, because it was in effect in, I believe, beginning in 2000, it does not even mention the Flynn effect. And so if trial counsel had decided to put on an expert to testify to the Flynn effect, that expert would have been severely impeached on cross because he or she would have to concede that the DSM does not even mention Flynn effect, let alone mandate numerical adjustments based on it. And even the DSM-5 now, that's now in effect, that's all it does is just mention the Flynn effect. It says that the Flynn effect and I think something about the practice effect or things that could affect a score, but doesn't say that the numbers should be adjusted. And something else that counsel would have to keep in mind is opposing counsel's case, Quince, he filed with his 28J letter. What's interesting about that case is it notes that in 2015, the AAIDD had a publication recognizing the Flynn effect, but the procedural history in that case actually reveals that in 2008, the same time as the trial here, the AAIDD did not mention the Flynn effect. And so these are the kind of things counsel has to think about in deciding whether to present Flynn effect evidence, and as I argued in my brief, run the risk that it could distract the jury from the mitigation case otherwise. And this leads to a related point about as this court has already discussed, trial counsel had an expert who believed that petitioner was not intellectually disabled, and in fact, there were two experts who said that.
Why on earth would a defense counsel introduce that evidence?
Well, first, it did play into a mitigation case about his borderline intellectual disability. And so a lot of what is mitigating about being intellectually disabled or borderline, setting aside the Atkins aspect.
I could understand introducing, at least arguing that he was borderline disabled as a proposition of mitigation, but to suggest the opposite, I just think that's wacko. What am I missing? I mean, I must be missing something.
Your Honor, well, first, again, kind of separating the claims. As to the Atkins aspect, use of the Flynn effect was simply foreclosed by state law. Even before
Smith... Well, but this is, we're not evaluating this under state law standards. We're evaluating this under U.S. constitutional law standards.
That is correct, Your Honor. It is, we are, you know, analyzing clearly established Supreme Court law, but if counsel can't do something under state law, it's not unreasonable to not do something that state law simply forecloses. And then as to the mitigating aspect of this claim, Flynn effect would in this case come down to a few points difference in his IQ. That is the difference in the substance of the case that counsel could have presented with Flynn effect versus what was actually presented. And so on that note, I would like to just discuss some things that Dr. Rui was able to say as part of what he said.
Why do you think the Flynn evidence would have been distracting or confusing to a jury? I mean, it's already hearing, you know, a lot of other mental health related evidence. I don't particularly see why it would be all that complicated for the jury to have an additional factor in the mix.
I think first, Your Honor, because it would involve a claim that petitioner can't be considered intellectually disabled under the Flynn effect, under state law, but that if you consider this highly contested claim and a battle of the experts would have been generated, which petitioner never contests, then there would be a few points difference in his IQ scores. And this
but they're critical points. They're not just a few points. They're critical points.
Again, just as to the mitigating aspect of the claim, because I contend it would not have been admissible as to the Atkins aspect, even if we give him the benefit of the Flynn effect, it would get him down to 73. But he basically assumes that with the standard error of measurement, that would bring him to the low end of that bell curve. But in reality, as I showed in my brief, there's only a 16% chance he's within the range of intellectual disability. Because standard error of measurement does follow a bell curve, we know, assuming a standard deviation of plus or minus 5, it's 68% likely that his true score is between 70.5 and 75.5, which means it's only 32% likely it's outside of that range and only 16% likely it's below that range. And so that's the bottom line that trial counsel would have been arguing to the jury is, consider this.
You know, he only needs to snag one juror, though, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
16% of that jury pool.
But if we consider what was presented overall and the other evidence that Dr. Rui provided, for example, he explained that petitioner's IQ put him at the fifth percentile, meaning 95% of people are operating at a higher level, and testified also to his significant neurocognitive impairments, pronounced problems remembering information, that he had difficulty with impulse control and making good decisions. When we consider all of that, that was before the jury as part of the mitigation case, and the strength of the aggravators, there's not a reasonable probability of a different outcome. And even
with a lawyer, here's what troubles me about this case. With a lawyer who's arguing that he is not disabled, and in not offering other evidence of disability that would indicate to a series of facts that which he could argue to the jury that his client was disabled and they should have mercy and they should consider all of these facts in mitigation. Instead of arguing that, he's arguing that the guy's he's not intellectually disabled and. Can I have an answer to my question? Because it seems to me, and I'll repeat the word, why would he do that?
Because it's a highly contested theory where his
yes,
expert would...
highly contested. I'm not talking even about the Flynn effect for the moment. I'm talking about any theory. Why wouldn't he introduce mitigating evidence? Why wouldn't he play on the fact that his client is right at the very bottom of of all the testing, I mean, you said you give him the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. You say 5%. His lawyer didn't give him that benefit.
He absolutely did, Your Honor. That 5% number I was reading was from trial testimony. That is, Dr. Rui testified that petitioner's IQ put him at the 5th percentile, meaning 95% of people are operating at a higher level. In particular, if this court looks in the range of, this would be volume 11 of the transcripts, pages 2,849 and 50, that right there is where Dr. Rui is testifying to his borderline intellectual disability. So it was not a mitigation case of, oh, he's not intellectually disabled, end of story. The meat of that argument, of course, setting aside, you know, the Flynn effect and this numerical adjustment, was already before the jury. It was made very clear to the jury that his borderline intellectual disability was impairing to him. I already mentioned Dr. Rui explained
Judge Timkovich's question was, why would it confuse the jury to have the lawyer introduce evidence, which was already under study, as I said, back as far back as 2000, and had been introduced in other cases? Why would it confuse the jury to introduce that type of evidence to buttress the disability of this defendant?
I think just because it's a difficult concept to explain, norm obsolescence, to try to explain to a jury. I mean, I have trouble, honestly, even explaining it myself, that basically, you know, if it's been a while since the test has been normed, that you have to account for that as far as the sample you're comparing to and make these adjustments. And even if we, with the benefit of hindsight, may look back and think, I would have made a different decision and not found that confusing, we have to judge this from counsel's perspective at the time. And counsel could reasonably decide that norm obsolescence is something that would be difficult to explain to a jury. And certainly it might be simpler to see whether it would be confusing or not confusing if petitioner actually proffered an expert who explains all this. But that is another reason that this claim fails, is that in post-conviction, petitioner gave no indication that he had or could obtain an expert that would testify to the Flynn effect. And in fact, he even submitted an affidavit by Dr. Rui about in regard to a separate ineffective assistance claim based on alleged mental health issues, in which Dr. Rui said nothing about the Flynn effect and didn't disavow his trial testimony that petitioner is not intellectually disabled or give any indication. Go ahead, Your Honor.
At the habeas stage before the district court, didn't counsel seek to introduce evidence to call an expert on the Flynn effect?
He did, Your Honor.
And did the district court say, oh, no, we're not going to hear that because it's not allowed under Oklahoma law?
I don't remember the exact basis of the district court's denial, but the denial was correct because under Penholster, this court is limited to the record that was before the state court.
Okay. So you lay your defense on Penholster.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you represent the state in the state habeas proceedings?
No, Your Honor. Yeah.
I just had this question about was the Flynn effect as a mitigating factor briefed in that case? I went back and forth with counsel on mm-hmm. it was, you know, fairly presented, and I just wonder if the state understood the petition to raise this argument.
No, Your Honor, I don't remember exactly the state's response and if the state was required to file a response. The way our post-conviction works, even in capital cases, the state doesn't file a response unless the Court of Criminal Appeals calls for it. And so I honestly can't recall, but I think if they did, the state didn't recognize it because the state didn't even recognize this as a claim at the district court stage.
If it was fairly presented by Mr. Postel, the OCCA would have been wrong in saying that it was not relevant evidence, right, under Lockett and Edding. That would have been erroneous, wouldn't it?
If that is what the court were referring to, yes, there are limits. Even though state evidentiary rules apply in second stage, there are limits to that because of Lockett and the general rule that all relevant mitigating
Lockett,
evidence
Lockett
can come
would
in.
Say that Flynn effect evidence is relevant to a mitigation case, right?
Your Honor, I think it would depend on the expert because the court of, or excuse me, the state court, and this court has said this is correct before, can still apply like a Daubert standard to expert testimony, even in a second stage. And so included in that, it has to be reliable. And so I think, the timing would...
So your answer is maybe.
Yes, Your Honor. My answer would be maybe to that. And I would also like to make a point about Hall. In 2016, this court decided Smith, and in Smith addressed this issue about Hall and the Flynn effect and said that it provides no clearly established law that Flynn effect must be considered. And moreover, at the time of the 2012 decision on post-conviction by the Court of Criminal Appeals, Hall had not been issued yet and cannot constitute clearly established law for that purpose. But even if we look at Hall and then Moore, the Supreme Court's most recent discussion of intellectual disability standards, that's the case out of Texas, I think it shows why it would not be unconstitutional not to consider the Flynn effect. Petitioner's counsel essentially concedes that we don't see Flynn effect outside the capital context. And what's interesting about Moore versus Texas, the 2017 case, is there Texas was relying on its so-called Brezino factors and also required that adaptive deficits must be related to intellectual functioning deficits, which it called its relatedness requirement. And the Brezino factors had no support in the general medical community. And what the Supreme Court said was, indeed, Texas itself does not follow Brezino in contexts other than the death penalty. For example, the relatedness requirement Texas defends here is conspicuously absent from the standards the state uses to assess students for intellectual disabilities. And even within Texas's criminal justice system, the state requires the intellectual disability diagnoses of juveniles to be based on the latest edition of the DSM. Texas cannot satisfactorily explain why it applies current medical standards for diagnosing intellectual disability in other contexts, yet clings to superseded standards when an individual's life is at stake. And here, petitioner can't point to any other context where we see the Flynn effect, and then even within the capital context, there is not a consensus on Flynn. That the court said that in Hooks. And so even if we take the broad principles from the most recent Supreme Court cases, that it matters how the medical community at large defines intellectual disability, petitioner hasn't shown that the Flynn effect should require these kind of adjustments, even in the capital context. And a couple more points I'd like to make on the Flynn effect. And again, this is referring to the mitigating aspect, and given the lack of an expert, there are some other unresolved questions. We don't know whether these were antiquated tests that were administered to petitioner that would even be in need of adjustment based on the Flynn effect. And there are some indications that petitioner's obtained scores aren't higher than his true scores, such as the fact that he has corroborating scores. And if this court has no further questions, I would ask the court to please affirm the denial of habeas relief.
Thank you, counsel. Okay, Mr. Nance, you have rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have to say it is absolutely unreasonable for a defense counsel in a capital case to be satisfied with having a key matter decided solely as a matter of state law. If Mr. Edding's lawyer had done that, when the trial judge says, I'm not going to consider your mitigating case, and the Court of Criminal Appeals said, that's okay, we wouldn't have Eddings. Lawyers who defend capital cases have to hold the proceedings to the standard of the Constitution. And you can't say, well, as a matter of state law, you just can't do that. Now, as regards what the Court of Criminal Appeals did in this case, it did a flat ban. It didn't do a Daubert review of the Flynn evidence and say, well, I've looked at it. It's not based on established principles and methods. It's just not reliable. You just can't use it. It didn't say, well, it's on the wrong end of the bell curve. You know, we're going to make a bell curve here, and you only get 16% is over the top. I mean, if a guy's running a football in and he gets only 16% across the goal line, but he's got the ball there, it's a touchdown. It just said it's a flat ban. And there's no justification for that. The whole Eddings line says, and Judge Timkovich, I think your line of questioning was right, it's mitigating under Eddings and Lockett and all of those things.
Right, we'd have a different posture if it had been, you know, introduced by trial counsel and the trial court had disallowed it, or the OCCA had held that was constitutionally permissible. It was never introduced at trial, so we're somewhat in the realm of speculation. It comes back to my earlier question. It was per se deficient performance here, and I guess per se prejudicial not to introduce Flynn evidence in 2008, right?
Yeah, I think it was per se deficient performance because you've got Atkins on the books and you're that far from having an Atkins defense. And even if you don't, you could put on an expert to say something that would help the jury understand Gil Postel's situation and humanize him. And you could say in the intellectual field, he is mentally retarded. And that's something, it's ugly, but it's a schoolyard chant. It's something one kid says against that.
It occurred to me, we're focusing in on the trial counsel, but as far as we can tell from this record, the two experts never raised Flynn either.
You are correct on this record, Your Honor.
Ms. Hunt mentioned that it was raised by Dr. Ruing an affidavit. I just if it was well established in the psychiatric literature at the time, one would expect their mental health experts who's conducting IQ tests to have told the lawyer about it. Do we know if that happened? If not, why not?
We don't. No, that's just the answer. We don't know why that was.
How can we jam the lawyer for not raising it if even two experts didn't raise it?
Well, because the lawyer's supposed to know the law, and Atkins is the law, and there's law coming down from courts of appeals, and there are articles in the criminal defense journals saying there's this Flynn effect thing. We don't expect.
I'm with you on that. I just think it's odd that we're holding the lawyers to a higher standard than the experts.
Isn't it part of a lawyer's standard of care, though? I mean, to retain an expert who has more expertise than the lawyer, and in this case, the trial counsel retained a neuropsychologist with two doctorate degrees. And how can we say that he didn't satisfy his standard of care at the time to rely on this expert who should have more expertise than he does about something like the Flynn effect that wasn't recognized in the DSM? How can the lawyer be violating his standard of care?
Because
he retained that expert, that qualified expert, and the expert either didn't know about it or didn't think it was significant enough to...
Your Honor, because I think the lawyer has the standard of care of doing the investigation and getting an expert that's going to give the winning defense.
So the lawyer should have known that this expert that he thought was well qualified and seemed well qualified really wasn't?
Should have.
I'm kind of confused about what we expect of our defense lawyers.
What I expect of the lawyer in this case is to find an expert who understands the Flynn effect and can put on expert testimony about it. You don't see it outside the capital context. That's true. It wouldn't matter in a bank robbery case.
Moreover, I don't think that it beats standard of care for a professional a lawyer, to rely on a psychologist who may be of a different view even on the Flynn effect to instruct him as to whether there is a Flynn effect. There's nothing in the record that tells us whether this expert knew or did not know about the effect. Isn't that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And I can't name the case, but I cited a case in which the court said the lawyer can't be bound by what the expert thinks. It's the lawyer's job to get the expert to put on the defense. It's a very technical thing, but the state has not challenged my arithmetic using the equation of the Flynn effect with the dates of the tests and the scores. And so, I mean, I think an expert would have put a PhD behind that, but they don't say I got the math wrong.
What do you say to the state's argument that our circuit decisions, even today, do not require the consideration of the Flynn effect in these type of cases?
Well, that's certainly correct in the Atkins line of cases. That's not the case in the Eddings and Lockett line.
Is our circuit precedent limited to Atkins line of cases and not to the mitigation line or the Eddings line of cases?
Exactly right, Your Honor. And because under the AEDPA, you have to look at the holding of Atkins, and the holding of Atkins didn't say anything about Flynn, so there's no obligation in an Atkins case to take Flynn evidence. But within the extremely broad, long, well-established definition of mitigating evidence under Lockett and Eddings and that line, it's mitigating.
Why didn't you seek or persist in your claim of error with respect to the remainder of the mitigation evidence that could have been introduced? Some would say should have been introduced.
I think more should have been introduced, but I guess like a deer in the headlights, I was seeing Flynn shine on me, and that's just what I focused on. So I apologize.
Is there a pending request for a COA on the other aspect of it?
I don't recall that there is on other mitigation. Well, no, wait a minute. We did raise one on the brothers for life without paroles, and that was denied. The brother who was part of the same shooting got 4 life without paroles.
Well, the father, who was also part of the shooting and the patriarch of the clan, as it were, he didn't get sentenced at all.
This is a crazy crime, literally a crazy crime, because the father had a bike. He's a biker, had a motorcycle accident, hit his head on the pavement. For trial, he was found incompetent, but he was not all there. And he thought that one of these victims, I think wrongly, falsely, just crazily thought one of these victims was responsible for his accident. And he and the older brother went, and my guy followed, and it's just tragedy. But
no, I understand. But it's one of the characteristics or traits of this intellectual disability is if you're emotionally intellectually challenged, is to kind of follow the leader.
You're a follower, not a leader. And if there was a leader and a planner in the Postel bunch, it wasn't Gil. It was Daddy and Brother. I appreciate your attention.
Thank you, Counsel. I think we understand your arguments. We appreciate your attendance this afternoon. The case shall be submitted, and Counsel.